Okay. This is side two of session number 39, recorded on May 14th, 2007, Walter Bowert's 68th birthday. And I'm just going to comment on the cutoff part of the previous side. I was going to say that it was really good to find a quote by Croker putting down LaRouche. And he makes LaRouche seem not such an outsider, but part of the establishment mode of creating consensus, at least the political establishment's modus operandi. Now, we will finish Croker, probably finish the Croker section on this side, and then we will go back to LaRouche and finish up LaRouche, and we'll find out what LaRouche has to say about Croker. Okay?
Rightio.
So, this final quote from Croker is from a book called...
Oh, listen, hold on. Before we do this final quote from Croker, just as a... This is off a little off topic, but just because it caught my attention, current event for the tape. You know, how you've talked about how YouTube allows us to, you know, talk back at the broadcast media, where in the old days, you know, it was one way. I just heard this little, while we were taking a break, little blurb on the news station about how since Don Imus was just fired from the air because some ethnic groups put pressure on him for things that he said, racial comments that he made, I guess, against black people. Two more DJs were just fired for making some ethnic group the butt of a joke. One of them was making fun of Chinese people, and a group of organized American Chinese people put pressure on the network to get rid of these guys, so they were fired. So there's another instance of we're talking back, organizing and talking back at the media, and in this case, actually having real effects, you know, getting people, getting media talking heads fired from the air. But then they went on to point out that, you know, they played some sound clips of guys that are on radio now, just saying the most vulgar, outrageous, you know, amazingly or ugly things you can say and getting away with it because they're not being regulated. So it's kind of interesting. The predators have moved into a new territory, but the YouTube effect is really having a strong impact on the collective media.
You mean radio? That is a fringe or chip radio?
Satellite radio.
Right. So you can. That's not the old TV political correctness landscape. So you can do it there. But
yeah, that's where Howard Stern moved to because he felt too confined in the in today's. Media environment. And
yeah, the old TV body is where political correctness continues powerfully, and so if you're in media...
And the radio, I mean, I don't know if you include radio as part of the TV landscape.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Mixed corporate media landscape.
Yeah.
The TV body. But it tends to be the one-way broadcasting that includes cable. But the thing is that you can be in the laws of the TV landscape. You can be nailed for violating political correctness, which deals with tribal icons. And there are no tribal icons in the chip body. But if you're in a medium that's, quote, near the mainstream, near the body, then you're vulnerable if you're politically incorrect. But problems. The chip body, so only TV body is political correctness. So
mm-hmm.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. Because people can do, you know, do all kinds of offensive things in the world of the chip body or the YouTube or whatever. That's not, they're not going to get targeted necessarily by roving, you know, groups of people who are trying to protect their identity.
For the consensus, and so when Croker's talking about the scapegoat is creating consensus, that's for the TV landscape. Now the TV body. But the TV landscape is where there are still mythic images of tribal groups. Maybe not the individual point of view or the individual ethic, but the corporate tribal imagery for subatomic particles is the realm of the TV landscape and the realm of consensus. The situation is you have to preserve your tribal image in that landscape, that TV landscape.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not constitutive in terms of what the chip economy is doing to people and what the chip body's doing. And within that, there is no tribal iconic stature.
Right. So however, I did hear today that the intelligence agencies, FBI, et cetera, were putting pressure on either Google or the MySpace people to reveal names and IP addresses of people that they feel are potentially child molesters. And so MySpace people are having to, you know, make a legal decision as to whether or not that's private information and is protected under the law, or whether or not they should turn over thousands of, you know, their members to the police.
Well, the McClune predicted that the women would take over the old institutions and men would move into surveillance. So the FBI, is it the FBI who was looking for this?
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah, the FBI's role is enhanced in the chip body. They have to monitor that world.
Mm-hmm.
So they're monitoring, they're a chip body institution now, monitoring the chip landscape.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're protecting individuals. And individuals are individuals with chip bodies.
Mm-hmm.
So they got to protect, via the chip body, the old chemical body of individuals. That's their mandate, right?
Mm-hmm.
How well they do, another question. But that makes sense that the FBI is, they have to operate on the latest technological landscape.
Also, when we talk about child predators, we're not talking about an ethnic group that, where, you know, people can argue as to whether, you know, they feel, you know, like they're being picked on ethnically. Probably everyone feels that children need to be protected. So you get a unilateral agreement, yeah, we should go after those guys. Whereas any other subgroup, we'd say, oh, no, you can't go after those guys because you're being discriminating.
Right. And also they're protecting individuals.
Yeah.
Individual children.
Yeah.
So this final quote is from a book that came out in 1991, put together by Arthur Croker and Mary Louise Croker. It's called, they're the editors of a bunch of essays done by different postmodern kind of people or people sympathetic to Croker's thinking. And the book is called Ideology and Power in the Age of Lenin in Ruins. Ideology and Power in the Age of Lenin in Ruins, meaning the Soviet Lenin.
Mm-hmm.
So, Scott, you want to read this situation?
Yeah. This is, again, late 80s?
No, this is 91, and it's page Roman numer IX and X, so 9 and 10 in the preface, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So the first word, myths, is italicized.
Right. The myths of communism and capitalism, then as floating signs, this is hyphenated, degree 0 points, for the cancellation and imminent reversibility of all the polarities, the mutation of the socialists is in brackets, struggle for justice into cynical power, and the materialist dream of the liberals in brackets, flight from politics into the triumph of cynical ideology. Like, quote, strange attractors, unquote, in astrophysics, which can exercise such a deadly fascination because of their ability to alternate energy fields instantly, alternates italicized, the myths of state capitalism and state communism are alternating sides of the rationalist eschatology, the symptomatic signs of the appearance of the bimodern condition. Bimodern condition is italicized.
So after rationalist eschatology, colon, then the symptomatic signs of the appearance of the bimodern condition.
Bimodernism, that's with a question mark. That is the contemporary historical situation in which the great referential polarities instantly reverse fields, changing signs in a dizzying display of political repolarization, a violent metastasis in which all the referential finalities of the political code of the 20th century dash capitalism and communism most of all hyphen begin to slide into one another, actually mutating into their opposites as they undergo a fatal reversal of meaning. No longer justice versus the acquisitive instinct, power versus ideology, socialist history, socialists in brackets, versus consumer simulation, consumers in brackets, or economic liberalism, economics in brackets, versus political, that's in brackets, democracy. But now the instant reversibility of all the reference. Probably should read that again. Do you want to reread that sentence?
Okay. No longer justice versus the acquisitive instinct, power versus ideology, socialism versus consumerization, or economic liberalism versus political democracy, but now the instant reversibility of all the reference.
A fatal eclipse of the empire of the sign in which capitalism and communism do a big historical flip. Not just the myth of capitalism in desperate need of the communist, quote, other, unquote, to sustain itself, or communism as a barrier against the universalization of the commodity-form, but now communism aping the economic form, economics italicized, of primitive capitalism, and capitalism taking on the political form, politicals italicized, of the command economy of late communism. The capitalist societies, then, as the forward frontier of the communist valorization of power, and communist societies as the last and best of all the primitive capitalisms. In one, the inspiring faith in commercial accumulation, resuscitation of law of value of production machine, and in the other, the radical depoliticization of the population, its actual body invasion by totalitarian image reservoir under the control of a cynical political
mandarinate.
In one, the recuperation of the productivist myth of Franklin Delano Roosevelt as a policy of economic reconstruction, and in the other, the Leninist use of all the mass organs of media manipulation as a way of coordinating private opinion with the war machine.
So that's his take on the collapse of the Berlin Wall. And he brings in the term bimodernism. This is what Croker really is. He's not really a postmodernist. He's a bimodernist. So he introduces this term bimodernism as his catch-all pattern to describe what was happening in the late 80s and early 90s. And it's not a term.
Is bimodernism post-postmodern, or is it just a different take on postmodern?
Maybe a post-postmodern term. It's a different take on post what other people would consider postmodernism. Yeah. But I think he means it after it. And when he talks about the instant reversibility of all the reference, that's sort of like my image of tactility. He's dealing with the Android meme's tactile nature and all signs flipping into other signs. And McLuhan's old pattern of the West goes East and the East goes West, he does a pretty good update of that with reference to these political categories of capitalism and communism. But, you know, I just realized I didn't read the quotes. We usually go through them, then I read the main.
Right.
And I didn't read the Panic Zombies.
Well, if we're going to finish up Croker, I don't think we have time to do that. And I don't know if it's necessary, because we did go through and dissect it pretty good.
Well, we'll have time.
Okay, we'll go ahead then.
30 minutes or whatever.
Because there's a lot here in this bimodern thing. This is real Croker, meat Croker stuff here, where he's talking about the, you know, flipping of referential stuff.
Okay, let's go into that. I'll read the quotes later.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, just the first sentence, the myths of communism and capitalism, I mean, why does he refer to them as myths? They were actualities, even if they were orchestrated.
But he italicizes it.
Yeah.
Now, you notice on my chart, the corporate quadrant, I have mythic government.
Right.
And myth, as Owen defined it, was his term for virtual reality. Myth was the encapsulation of complex process.
Mm-hmm.
And a simplification almost, but an in-depth resonant icon. So in the 20th century, the iconoscope was a new reality. It was a new reality, new nature. So myths were real.
Well, when you get information overload to the point that you have to flip into pattern recognition, probably that pattern recognition becomes entry into mythic messages because
McLuhan would agree.
You're not analyzing information as facts anymore.
Well, yeah, you've got a lot of information, so you're just trying to catch the drift of it. And so McLuhan does substitute pattern recognition and myth. They're interchangeable.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it's myth as a practical filtering of stuff that's really hard to grasp, or just too much.
Mm-hmm.
Frank Zangroni has the phrase media simplex, simple and complex. That's another phrase for the mythic.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know if Croker is thinking of McLuhan when he does this, but I would accept it in McLuhan terms as the accurate statement of what communism and capitalism are. They're huge environments that are filtered through the TV landscape. So
right.
They have iconic logos representing them.
Right.
They talk about the age of Lenin in ruins. They also, in another essay, talk about the age of Reagan in ruins, too.
Mm-hmm.
So, since they're both disappeared, then their after images flip into each other.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
But the, let me just see if I do this.
Fractals are probably both simple and complex. They're probably a good example because in the details it's complex, but if you look at the pattern recognition, you're seeing the same patterns being repeating. And it's, so at the macro pattern recognition level, it's pretty simple, but if you zoom down into the detail level, it gets complex.
Right, and I say the fractal and the tone and the anamorphosis or the anamorphic is in the Croker zone. This paragraph moves from the fractal towards the anamorphic, the
mm-hmm.
The pure bizarre distortion of the icons, which is what he's trying to explain here,
right.
Or what he calls the reversibility of all the reference.
Mm-hmm.
But let me just read a few lines here and then see, you can stop me at any point, what you want commented on. The myths of communism, capitalism, then, as floating signs. Okay, so they're icons in the TV landscape, right?
Mm-hmm.
Degree 0 points. That mean that's all they are. It's just sense. For the cancellation and reversibility of all the polarities.
Yeah, so
they're there to be reversed.
What's there to be reversed?
The communism and capitalism, these degree 0 points. It's almost
what
like they don't have any reality.
What sense are they reversed?
The myths, well, he's going to explain it.
Uh-huh.
The myths as floating signs for the cancellation and imminent reversibility of all the polarities that they used to represent. So for the communist side, they were supposedly the struggle for justice.
Uh-huh.
It mutates into cynical power. That would be, what's his name, Yeltsin.
Right, in the mind of the Western world, in the mind of the Soviet world, they might not see it that way.
No, remember, a lot of people in the 90s in Russia wished that the Soviets were back because they really starved and suffered.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a lot of hatred of Moscow.
Yeah, from within the borders.
Yeah, within the Russian borders.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have, on the capitalist side, the materialist dream of the liberal flight from politics to the triumph of cynical ideology. So they're both cynical.
Mm-hmm.
And cynical ideology means that the West won the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
Reality is the West was, as time unfolded, is equally bankrupt and disappeared, as we've seen over the last 10 years.
Well,
in the Bush administration.
Yeah, but not like the Soviet Union. I mean, everybody was suffering in the Soviet Union. You get the idea. I mean, I don't know out there, but the material the scarcity of material needs were like a pretty bad, and much worse than even the United States.
Right, but we know that there's no supposedly no middle class anymore in the United States.
For
15 years.
I don't believe that. I mean, I don't know what you defend. You define as middle class. I'm an average wage earner, and I suppose I'm middle class. I don't know. Maybe not.
No, I'm not saying that's my view. I'm saying that there is a big meme out there. You hear it on your Coast to Coast show. You hear it in Air America. You hear it all over the place. How
class is being threatened at being disabled.
Yeah, well, a lot of people go so far as say it's gone.
Uh-huh.
Anyways, yeah, definitely.
Well, in terms of, you know, two cars in every garage and all that stuff, I suppose you're right. But
yeah, but no, there is this anxiety of lack of material, of financial security, but there is definitely a more advanced in software industrial environment in the West.
Yeah.
So, but he's saying the materialist dream, which is what we're talking about, for the middle class.
I mean, what happened to the middle class in America is it didn't disappear. It's just that both mom and dad are out working to keep it going now.
Yeah, and the materialist dream of the liberal flight from politics. So Coker thinks liberals, they don't want to get too involved in political issues of justice, then that might tend to push them more to the left. So they leave that issue or those concerns and go into materialism. But it has shifted into the triumph of syndical ideology. It's like, to the degree that people are losing their middle-class guarantees and assumptions, they go around celebrating that they won the Cold War. It's like that book by Johnny Frank, I think, about the people in Kansas vote in the Republicans who undermine their budgets in Kansas.
Yeah.
That paradox.
Yeah.
But it seems that the people are more involved in the TV landscape. The Kansas middle America people are more involved in their saving face in the TV landscape. And so they find it more important to uphold the image of America as the winner of the Cold War.
Well, that's why they voted Bush in. You know, they were trying to maintain this image.
So that's what he means by cynical ideology.
Yeah, so, and that's represented by the shift from Carson to Letterman.
Yeah. And it says, like strange attractors, in quotes, like strange attractors in astrophysics, which can exercise such a deadly fascination because of their ability to alternate energy fields instantly, the myths of state capitalism and state communism are alternating sides of the rationalist eschatology. Eschatology mean final and mysterious ultimate things. And the rationalist eschatology would be visual and kinetic space in McLuhan terms.
Mm-hmm.
This alternating of one into the other, and he's going to explain in the second paragraph how they become each other.
Right.
Tweedledee and Tweedledum. They are the symptomatic signs of the appearance of the bimodern condition. And I would say bimodernism is the tactile interplay. It's not the visual yin-yang. Visual spaces, yin-yang, or dialectic. He's trying to describe the flickering, which is an approximate image of how maybe the tactile sense works, right? It's
right.
Flickering among and organizing the sensory inputs.
So he's looking at the schizophrenia, but he doesn't really see the quadrophenia.
Well, I think he's getting at quadrophenia. He doesn't see it because he doesn't want to bring in McLuhan's tetrad. He may not be too well-versed on it. But yes, his bimodernism... And you'll see the way it describes it as a tactile flipping. You can get more distinct constituent parts of the tactile flipping if you think of the quadrophenia or the four parts of the tetrad in there. He kind of flattens it out.
Yeah.
But that's because he's coming out of the Marxist dialectical materialist tradition.
Right. I didn't realize that strange attractors called caused alternate energy fields that flip one to the other. I'm not up on my astrophysics, but you don't happen to know what that refers to, do you?
Well, do you ask me if I happen to know?
Yeah.
Well, the strange attractor is trying to say there's a coherence in chaos.
That chaos is that there's a chaotic process of what appear to be random elements all whirling around and trying to find their place so as to match ultimately the pattern of the strange attractor and actually come into relief as something that, you know, like it's going, like between octaves it looks chaotic, but as it enters into the next octave it becomes coherent again.
Yeah, it's like self-organization.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So if you think of the tactile organ, tactile function is to organize mm-hmm. something into a coherent self, then that's how I would relate to a strange attractor as another term for tactility.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I haven't actually considered that before. That's a good one.
Yeah. So then he says, bimodernism, like what's that, bimodernism, that is the contemporary historical situation in which the great referential polarities instantly reverse fields, changing signs in a dizzying display of political repolarization. They must remain polarized, but they got to become the other. Right?
Yeah.
A violent metastasis or cancer in which all the referential finalities of the political code of the 20th century, capitalism and communism most of all, begin to slide into one another, and that sounds like tactility,
yeah.
Begin to slide into one another, actually mutating into their opposites as they undergo a fatal reversal of meaning.
Well, I can almost see that in a personal way as my folks who flip from staunch Republicans who are now Democrats. You know, they went from Republican to independent with Perot, and now they're Democrats.
Right. And this sliding into one another, mutating into their opposites as they undergo a fatal reversal of meaning, it's almost like synesthesia.
Mm-hmm.
Things becoming something else.
Mm-hmm.
But he keeps it limited to two aspects.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a book about ideology and power, and so I guess that's dealing with capitalism and communism. Then he says, no longer justice versus the acquisitive instinct, you know, communism versus capitalism, power versus ideology. I guess that would be, power would be communism versus ideology is capitalism, or they could be interchangeable.
Well, Marxism
there.
Is ideology.
What?
Marxism is ideology.
I know, so that's
capitalism.
Interchangeable there. Socialist history versus consumer simulation. Now, remember, it's simulation. That's where we're talking about the materialist dream evaporates into software pride
mm-hmm.
or simulation over icons.
Mm-hmm.
So consumer, it's like branding,
mm-hmm.
what they call branding, people buying brands. Socialist history versus consumer simulation or economic liberalism versus political democracy. But now the instant reversibility of all the reference. So no longer either of these solid polarities. And because they are tactile and interplay and intermingle synesthetically, then you're going to get the next few sentences describing how they become each other, aspects of each other. So, a fatal eclipse of the empire of the sign, that would be the TV landscape, in which capitalism and communism do a big historical flip. Not just the myth of capitalism and desperate need of the communist other, that's the old version, to sustain itself. That's like the scapegoating. Consensus needs another.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So the Joseph McCarthy's, Lyndon Roos, Reagan, and Nixon's were the other to maintain the viability of consensus.
Well, some people think that's why Bush went into Iraq, because we didn't have another and we needed one.
Right. And Croker's saying that kind of needing another is not an accurate description of what's going on, because within tactility there's no polarity. So the other, one thing can be the other. You take on the other. I mean, you become the other because you're talking to yourself.
Yeah.
So the...
give me a more concrete idea. What is that idea?
Well, he spells it out here. So run through. In one, the inspiring faith in the... Okay, the capital societies then is the forward frontier of the communist valorization of power. So there they mean communist as power. So power versus ideology means power is communist versus ideology capitalist. So the capital societies take on the communist valorization of power. So they become that part of the communist society. They become power. And the communist societies is the last and best of all the primitive capitalism. they don't become completely the other.
Mm-hmm.
Or, shall we say, they become the other without having the other.
Yeah.
In one, the inspiring faith in commercial accumulation and the resuscitation of law of value of the production machine, that's that would be which one is which here?
Well, you know, where he's talking about the communism aping the economic form of primitive capitalism, well, you know, I mean, that could be simply explained by the fact that once communism was, when the wall went down, communism was no longer an organizing force, and people saw that, you know, people in the West were making a living, so it would make sense for them to try to organize among primitive capitalistic.
Yeah, but primitive capitalism led to the takeover by the so-called Russian mafias.
Yeah.
That's primitive capitalism.
Right.
But where it says here the capitalists, in one, the inspiring faith in commercial accumulation and resuscitation of law of value of the production machine. Okay, that's Russia. And in the other, the radical depoliticization of the population, that's America. Like that guy talking about the scapegoaters says that it's an apathetic, political apathetic population in the United States, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's actual body invasion by a totalitarian image reservoir under the control of a cynical political mandarinate. There's your cynical ideology.
What's a mandarinate?
That's like government by committee or...
like mandating?
No, mandarins are the old Chinese term for the educated class, the
mm-hmm.
professors, the teachers.
Mm-hmm.
So in this case, it would be the technocrats,
mm.
or at least the images of the technocrats in the political world. A cynical political mandarinate, that'd be like a Kissinger,
mm-hmm.
a consultant to the political classes, and the politician himself. In one, the recuperation of the productivist myth of Franklin Delano Roosevelt as a policy of economic reconstruction. That's so. There's Russia becoming the FDR dream, and in the other, the Leninist use of all the mass organs of media manipulation as a way of coordinating private opinion with the war machine. That's America taking on the software control that was under Stalin and the Politburo.
Mm-hmm.
So they are becoming the other. That they.
Yeah, well, you know, people say we're losing our freedoms to Homeland Security. It's like the new communism taking over the West, and, you know, so.
But not just the myth back up here, not just the myth of capitalism in desperate need of the communist other, so not just that, to sustain itself. Or communism as a barrier against the universalization of the commodity form. But now communism aping the economic form of primitive capitalism and capitalism taking on the political form of the command economy of late communism. It's not cut black and white in the sense of having an other. They kind of maintain themselves but take on in the TV landscape different aspects of what they thought they didn't have.
Mm-hmm.
And then they keep flipping back and forth. Even the images of them trying to be one or the other is not stable. And so that's why you can't say it's just an other, a stable other. Because Russia is trying to become the capitalist, but by the end of the 90s, people want to get back to the old ways.
Yeah.
America is trying to become Bolshevik or Leninist, but the population is pretty angry about it. And so they have to maintain, that's what happens, I guess, in the battle between Democrats and Republicans. The Republicans put on an image of the liberal media. So the Republicans act like the Russian search for justice as they, within the political landscape, they maintain that meme while representing through Fox TV a Leninist use of the mass organs of media manipulation. even though the content of what they represent is supposedly for a safety valve from the liberal media. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the mixture of these things, it's more than stable black and white others, or what McLuhan called the West becoming the East and East becoming West. It's more complex, and that's why it's applicable, this phrase, the instant reversibility of all the reference. They flip back and forth so that Russia doesn't stay in its effort to become primitive capitalism. It flips back to the justice side.
Yeah, sure. Well, they, you know, I mean, if they're trying to become capitalistic, but it's all being run by a mafia, eventually people are going to demand justice. And
right. So they're trying to become something different, and they are conditioned over their historical legacy of previous environments and political and bureaucratic apparatuses limit their attempt to become another. And they don't want to, and they don't become the other exactly as the other is. They don't become modern capitalists, they become primitive capitalists.
Mm-hmm.
And the capitalist side is they don't become, what was the phrase, the resuscitation of the law of value of the production machine. They undermine that by going global. Globalization.
Right.
So, I like the way Croker tries to show this flipping of categories into each other, what he calls bimodernism. That's pretty good.
I heard somebody ranting on the radio the other day about how, you know, we got to get past this idea of nation states and countries and all this, because, you know, you know, America is a corporate entity, China is a corporation, you know, Russia is a corporation. You know, he's thinking in terms of, these are just all big corporations now. They're not, you can't think of them in the old terms of, you know, countries.
That's in the TV body landscape. They have iconic tribal consensus.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Japanese were known for that in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Japan is a corporate monster.
Mm-hmm.
Invading the rest of the world. So, as more and
that's
more
a restructuring of power when you know a country goes from being a nation to becoming a corporation.
You say that's a restructuring of power?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a, well, it's the literate kinetic industrial nation subsumed into the TV landscape, and then it has a brand. It has an ideology or a cultural image to save face because it's up against all the other cultures and nations in the TV landscape. So your image becomes way more important than your national boundaries because you're actually in this global membrane,
right?
Not limited to the chemical body apparatus of governments and national boundaries. So the syndrome of becoming a corporation is heavily influenced by the TV environment.
Right. Now they're talking about software you can add to your telephone that'll allow you to talk to somebody in China who only speaks Chinese, and, you know, your voice will be instantly translated into Chinese, and their voice will be instantly translated into English. That really is going to knock down barriers.
Yeah, and that's the chip body's tendency to make the user as king and customize everything for you, the user. So that you can interact with anybody, and everything is done for you. Like you just said, Chinese people don't know English, can hear you via their Chinese. So it creates a kind of solipsism. Everybody can stay within their own particular conditioned environments that they grew up in and interact with other environments that you know nothing about, like a kind of ESP, but never leave your little womb.
Yeah.
So... That's the ability of the chip to move past the rigidities of the corporate television landscape.
Mm-hmm. Right, so that goes on outside. Well, and then eventually you'll turn on TV and a news reporter in China will be talking to a news reporter in America, and they'll be using voice translation in the TV landscape or TV body.
Right, in the TV landscape. And so they, but it also could be a response, you subscribing to these news services, and it's just coming to you.
Mm-hmm.
Tailor-made, customizing.
Mm-hmm.
The digital body really makes that more and more a reality.
Yeah.
So what you would have is a Chinese reporter talking to an American reporter about you, Scott Norris.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, then we're all moving in the direction of experiencing Bob's reality, where the media is reflecting the individual.
Yeah, the Truman Show.
Yeah. Well, you don't consider yourself to be like a Truman experiment, but yet you see yourself, the media is aping Bob all the time.
Yeah, and I don't...
We're moving in the direction where it'll be aping each one of us.
Yeah, I'm a prototype for that syndrome that's coming.
You're you know, a decade ahead of the pack.
Yeah, I'm the artist of it, or the anti-environment, the warning of it.
Yeah.
Like Joyce is finning his wake, miming the digital world, you know, 50 years before it.
Right.
Tuned in.
Well, we don't have too much to worry about. You don't sound like a tormented soul.
Right, you're assuming Joyce was?
No, but, you know, I'm saying that you're not. If you know, if we're all going to end up in Bob's anachrony zone, it doesn't sound like it's hurting you too much. But then you know how to manage it. Maybe not
right.
Other people might wipe out.
Okay, so the three quotes we've done tonight, I'm going to review them and note how Croker is describing from the chip body or Android meme perspective what is happening, or at least the chip landscape perspective, what's happening to the TV landscape. So you have the entertainment world of panic zombies, Carson and Letterman. You have the political world of presidents and political extremists. And then you have the global TV landscape of the icons of communism, capitalism. So you see they're all kind of intertwined and show different aspects of the perspective that Croker brings to the 80s. All right?
Mm-hmm.
So with that in mind, let me read through the quotes again.
All right.
Panic Zombies, Carson and Letterman. If advertisements are the truth-sayers of the TV programs, which are their media vehicles, then Elpo Dog Food names the Johnny Carson Show correctly. Johnny and Ed are America's favorite pets. The show occurs between prime time and sleepy time with all of the nocturnal pleasure of a regular bowel movement. The Carson Show is, anyway, a real panic scene. Not, however, panic of the frenzy type, but the reverse, panic inertia. An unchanging format for a static submass, which has disappeared into the white suburban Bantus and taken to Carson as his nightly excremental habit. As Carson likes to insist, it's just entertainment. He's the parasite, the audience, the bored voyeur, and the guests changing particles in promotional culture. I would just add, promotional culture is the TV landscape. That's a phrase Croker uses in reference to the TV landscape. Another one is ultra-modernism is the TV landscape. And David Letterman, he's the Johnny Carson of the Reagan youth generation. A little cynicism, a little humor for a generation that the American political philosopher Michael Weinstein has described as distinguished by a, quote, strong sense of self, but a weak ego, unquote. As a graduate of Ball State University in the middle of Indiana, Letterman has moved his Hoosier personality from the regions into the center of New York media culture. With Letterman, the dinner party runs its course from hospitality to hostility to the hospital. Letterman is, in fact, the perfect predator of his audience. His popularity rests with denigrating the audience. Of his guests, celebrities are brought out as living targets. Of himself, as a supposedly unlikely talk show host. And of TV. The show, Tonight with David Letterman, parodies the medium of talk shows. While the secret of Johnny Carson's success is as a cultural parasite, Letterman is a media predator. Here, America at Night finds its final destiny as a Hoosier predator, alternating between envy and resentment. Now, in the next section, this is the political angle on the TV landscape. An associate of Croker writes, what is generally taken as extremism in the United States is the opposite of the collective state of political apathy that is maintained by those in positions of power. There are two ways of understanding the phenomenon. First, the relative quiescence and political ignorance of the American population represents an opportunity, a field of action for activists in quotes. The lack of political consciousness is fertile ground for manipulation based upon the most exaggerated claims. In this sense, apathy tends to encourage extremism in quotes. Second, the presence of extremists works to the benefit of those in positions of power and authority who are quick to explain that any deviation from the political orthodoxy of the moment will degenerate into irrationality and violence. Social criticism is thus a sign of irresponsibility. So there you get in the Nixon era the phrase, the icon of the silent majority. He said he represented the silent majority. They were responsible. In other words, the myth of consensus implies the creation of scapegoats. Over the past 20 years, individuals like Joseph McCarthy, Lyndon LaRouche, Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, etc., have succeeded in imposing themselves upon the public by profiting from the civil apathy and political ignorance of the North American population through the process of scapegoating. Products of the myth of consensus, or the TV landscape, these men have also contributed to its destruction. That's the paradox of the decentralist effect of television. You create a disease and offer the cure. So products of the myth of television, these men have also contributed to its destruction. Then the third quote deals with the global theater landscape and the icons and brands of that stage. It says, the myths, in italics, the myths of communism and capitalism, then, as floating signs, degree zero points, for the cancellation and imminent reversibility of all the polarities. An aside. So they're there to be canceled and flipped. All right? Mm-hmm. Whereas another is something, and other, capital O, is something more stable, not to be flipped.
Mm-hmm.
So then he follows up saying, the mutation of the socialist struggle for justice into cynical power. And